everybody. Welcome to the Afterword. I'm Dave Tish. You know, I want to talk for a moment about what happens to a human life when everything falls apart. Now, look, I hope this hasn't happened to you, but if I'm honest, and I know a lot of your stories out there because you write in, you tell me, and because I know you personally, some of you have experienced a moment where everything just fell apart. The ancients talked about the pillars or the columns that held up the sky, you know, even an ancient totem pole holding up the sky like a tent pole. What happens when those pillars crumble and it feels like the sky comes crumbling down, like all of reality, your whole world comes crumbling down? It's never easy. You know, I wouldn't wish that on anyone, not even my worst enemy, but it just happens. Jesus even promises it. He says, in this world, there will be troubles. He gives this beautiful illustration at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, you know, there's a man who builds his house on sand, another who builds his house on rock. And when the storms of life come, he doesn't say, you know, sometimes people are unlucky and the storms of life hit them. He says, you know, look, the storms of life are going to hit you. So when life comes undone, what do you run to? What's square one? What's foundational? And we're starting a new sermon series on the Apostles' Creed. And in many ways, the Apostles' Creed is like a foundational document. It's back to square one. It's reducing life into what do we actually know? And I was talking with the student ministries team just about how are we going to talk and teach this ancient creed, which is 2,000 years old, to a bunch of, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-olds. Like, what? How are we going to talk to our junior high and our high school students about this? And they were just brainstorming. And it struck me that oftentimes in movies and stories that we all love, when there's a moment when the main character has a crisis, when the world falls apart on them, what do? They go back to square one, like Spider-Man. Spider-Man's world falls apart. And what does he do? He goes back to the deepest paternal relationship he has with his Uncle Ben and the words his uncle said to him: with great power comes great responsibility. And this becomes a guiding principle for what Spider-Man is, what Peter Parker's gonna, how he's gonna live, you know? Or like Simba, or like in The Lion King, when Simba's world falls apart and he starts running away, just running from his past, running from his future, Rafiki finds him and what's he say? He's like, remember who you are. And that simple phrase is what reminds Simba that, you know, look, I'm the son of Mufasa. Like, I'm the king of the lions. I need to go back to the pride. Or Harry Potter, when the world falls apart, like in crisis, he's got a physical and visual reminder on his forehead, the mark. And that mark reminds him of two things. Number one, my parents died for me. They died protecting me. And number two, Voldemort can't kill me and he's my enemy. So I need to march right for that because that's my destiny. Even as we were brainstorming, one of the guys in our student ministry team, Rob, he's a huge Beatles fan. He's like, you know, when the Beatles get stuck, when they got stuck creatively, when they couldn't produce, they would go, John would say, hey, look, who are we? We're a bunch of teenagers in a garage who love to play Elvis. Let's go back to that. And they just start playing Elvis and start jamming. And out of that just comes some, they start writing Let It Be and like Come Together. It's just like, it just flows out of them because they get unstuck because they go back to the foundation of who they are. And I was even thinking in history, just like what happens in our big historical movements like Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. What is he doing? He's going back to the foundational documents. Like when the world's in turmoil, he goes back to the founding document, right? That all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. This is go back to square one. This is what we do. And so the Apostles' Creed in many ways is a go back to square one foundational document for Christians. It has been for generation, for all, literally millennia, Christians have depended on this creed, this collection of words and phrases that remind us about what's true, what's important, and what's most real about this universe. When everything falls apart, this is what's most true. I'm here with Jay Kim to talk about it. We're going to be talking about the Apostles' Creed for the next several weeks. We're going to go through it slowly, line by line, and talk about how, if we actually think about it, it can actually form us and change even the way we live. So Jay Kim's here. We're going to talk about this. This week, we're going to have like an overview, like why are we going through this? And also, we're going to talk about the first line in the Apostles' Creed, I believe. What does that mean? What does that look like? We're going to dive into that. So with that, let's just dive right in. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Afterword. I'm Dave Tish. Hey, Jay.
Hey, man.
So we're back.
We're back.
It's hot right now as we record this.
My goodness, is it hot.
My watch says it's 101 degrees outside. Luckily, not 101 degrees in here.
Yeah, air conditioning.
Boy, have you ever been more grateful for air conditioning? Is there a time in your life when you've been more grateful?
I mean, I've been in Phoenix, Arizona, and Las Vegas, Nevada in summer. I think the hottest weather I've ever been in was in Vegas one July, and I remember it got up to 116.
Yep, I've been in 117. It's a nightmare.
It was like, yep, it's unreal. It's almost...
I hiked the Grand Canyon in 117 degree temperatures.
That's insane.
Yeah, it was rough.
You know, when it gets that hot, something happens mentally where I feel worse right now in California with it being 101 than I did in Vegas when it was 118.
Why?
I think when it gets to that temperature, something mentally shifts. And I just kind of learn to embrace the pain or something. I remember it not bothering me that much. Well, this right now bothers me way more.
Is it maybe it's because it's home?
Yeah, like it shouldn't be this way here.
It's weird. It shouldn't be this hot.
But Vegas and Phoenix, places like that, you just kind of expect.
Now, here's the thing, though. I have air conditioning, so I can't really complain. In my house, I have air conditioning.
Yeah, not everyone does.
Yeah, and if you don't, it's miserable.
I went to drop something off at... my friends Nick and Liz Sakamoto, who, Nick plays bass here sometimes.
Shout out to Nick and Liz.
Nick and Liz, shout out to you guys. Just dropped something off at their house. They're in my life group, and they don't have AC. Oh, so no. I was talking to them last night a little bit, and it's I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's heat.
I don't know, man. I don't know how people do it.
I don't know either. Well, we're not here just to talk about the weather, although it is interesting. We're here to talk about...
We just lost 80% of our listeners that long.
What is this, a weather report? You guys stink. You guys stink. I can read a thermometer. I don't need that. Maybe we should transition to something like spiritual. You know, speaking of hot, hell's going to be hot. And one way to stay out of hell is Jesus the Christ.
I know, man. We all have people in our lives who totally would do that. So interesting.
Okay, so let me ask you a question, though. We are in a brand new sermon series called The Apostles' Creed.
Yes.
And we're talking about the Apostles' Creed.
Yeah.
So talk to me about, I always love to do this, what was the impetus in your head and heart for why this ancient creed? Because it's not technically, quote, biblical.
Yeah.
It's not actually in the Bible, but it's deeply historical.
Yes.
Why, like, we'll talk about that in a second. Talk about why this message at this time, because it is an ancient creed that Christians have been reciting for centuries.
Yeah.
Literally millennia.
Yeah.
So why this creed? What are we hoping? What are you hoping it will do on our people?
I think most of us can relate to sort of the general feeling of instability in our own lives personally, in our world, in our country. It's an election year, the Biden-Trump debate and just the madness and media fiasco of all of, just everything feels so unstable. We feel this way all the time. We feel this way very uniquely every 4 years as a nation. We certainly feel this way every time we open our news feeds and there is yet again another story of war or disaster. And it's not to minimize the importance of any of these things. It's just, I think there's this grating sort of, I don't know, low grade exhaustion that comes from a sense of like just constant uncertainty. But as Christians, as followers of Jesus, in the midst of uncertainty, in the midst of instability, there's actually really solid, stable ground that we stand on. And it's the story of the world that is the truest story of the world. And the Apostles' Creed, like you said, sure, it's maybe like extra biblical in the sense that these words specifically are not in the scriptures. But again, as we'll talk about, they are sort of an encapsulation of the Jesus story from those who wrote the New Testament biographies of Jesus. You know, it was a way for them to gather collectively and agree upon the story they were going to take to the ends of the earth. And I wanted us to spend time this summer as a church, again, as we ramp up toward whatever's ahead, you know, the election in the fall, yes, but so many things that feel uncertain and unstable. I wanted us to spend extended time going line by line through what is the unchanging, unshakable, 2 millennia years old story, which is the solid ground upon which we stand, and hopefully walk away with a sense of real confidence and comfort and courage and peace and stability.
There's a song that we sing. It's called This I Believe.
Yeah.
It's just a worship song.
Yeah.
And I remember early on, I think it was maybe you were just come on staff, or it was that summer, and we were singing that song, and I remember you said, like, this really affects me. And I felt it too. Yeah. There's something about singing this song, which is basically based on the Apostles' Creed.
Yeah.
It grounds me to the ancient river of God's church across continents,
yeah,
across language, across time and space, through dictators, across empires.
Yep.
All of the grandmas and grandpas that will never know their names,
right,
who were faithful, the work of God across the centuries, across the continents. And it makes me feel really, really, really small and really swept up. And it's really actually super calming to me,
yeah,
and inspirational to me. Yeah. What is that? What is that feeling? Is it because we're so atomistic, individualistic? Because we're so, think about the Silicon Valley. If it's not tomorrow, it's not, it's worthless.
Yeah.
It's like we're so future focused.
Right.
And it's the next, the next, the next. And, you know, even memes are so,
yeah,
short lived. Is it?
And we're also so sort of make your own way type of ethic, you,
yes,
know? Everywhere in the modern world, but especially in a place like Silicon Valley, where, you know, startup culture, that's not all bad, you know, like
the entrepreneurial spirit, right?
There's, yeah, real, sure, beauty and a lot of good that comes by way of sort of like pull yourself up by your bootstraps and go. But with the bigger things in life, or with life itself, I think we need to be like surrounded by something that helps us feel like we're not just constantly ping-ponging back and forth from this to that to the next thing based on what feels good right now, or that relentless pursuit of, like you said, the next thing. I think all of us as human beings, even the most entrepreneurial amongst us, long for, you know, the sort of timeless anchored reality that fixes us within a much larger story. That's the stuff that really moves me, you know, and inspires me. And, you know, when I think about my kids, it's like the beauty of having kids in many ways is, man, this is what I do now will affect these lives, which will then in turn affect other lives. And what is affecting these lives is because others who've gone before me have affected my life and so on. And there's a power in that, you know, and a real beauty in it. And I think we're all hungry for that. And the Apostles' Creed has been so helpful for me as a summary statement about that larger story in which I find my own story.
Transcendent is a word that kind of comes to mind.
It's, yeah,
like it's transcendent. Let's talk about the word. How would you describe the Apostles' Creed? I remember I was talking to a couple of our youth workers, and one of them was like, wait, The legend has it that the apostles, I was like, legend? Is that the right word? Mm-hmm. Well, like church tradition holds.
Yeah.
But, like how would you, because the idea is that there's a story,
yeah,
that the apostles, before they literally went out to the ends of the earth.
Yeah.
Like we're talking the 11 plus maybe Paul, but probably Matthias.
You know, Matthias, yeah.
The Judas, guy who took Judas's place.
Yeah.
And they're together. They're like, look, we're going to go to the ends of the earth. You go this way, Thomas, you go to India, yeah. You get curry, but no one else does. And the rest of you, we're all going to die except yeah. for John, you know, they didn't know that, but yeah. that's what's going to happen. They're yeah. going to spread across the known world.
Yeah.
And they're going to take the story out. And the idea is like, let's agree upon this creed.
Yeah.
But is it, what would you say church history tells us that or legend or story or?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely wouldn't say legend. I talked about it on Sunday. The earliest written version like that we have documented in writing of what we today call the Apostles' Creed dates to like the middle of the 4th century. So that's about 250 to 300 years after the resurrection and ascension. But the way we have it, without getting to all the nuts and bolts and details, I'm going to butcher his name, Tyrannius Rufinus, 4th century historian. He's a historian. He's not like, you know, a fictitious storyteller. He very matter-of-factly says, yeah, this creed was developed, we call it the Apostles' Creed, because it was developed by the apostles. And the story he tells is that story, that after Pentecost, these young men gather together, they know they're going to depart. And it's a really emotional scene. These guys are like, they're brothers. So they've spent every waking moment for 3 years of their, the three most formative years of their lives, walking with and living with Jesus. And then they watch him die together. So you think about the trauma and pain of that. And then they experience him resurrected. You think about the life-changing power of that. And now they're like, well, remember what our rabbi told us? Go, you know, to all the nations and baptize them and teach them. And so they're going to do that. And before they do, according to this historian, they gather together and they're like, what exactly are we going to teach them? And this is what they come up with. So I, you know, legend is too strong a word. I would probably say like church tradition tells us that these young men wrote a version of this. Now, of course, verbatim, maybe it wasn't exactly this, but it was this basically. Mm-hmm. And here we are today, 2000 years later, in a part of the world that they didn't even know existed, you know, reciting these same words.
Yeah.
This same story.
Let's talk about creeds for a second, because a lot of people are like, they don't understand. A lot of people, into if you don't study church history, you don't understand how important creeds are. Mm. Or even like you've talked in the past about the catechism, Westminster.
Yeah.
That's a form of a creed.
Yeah.
That's a form of a articulation of what a group of people believe. Why are creeds so important, and why is that such a foreign concept to us? We don't, I guess we sort of have a creed, like with our founding documents, for example, all men are created equal,
yeah,
endowed by their creator.
With that's a creed.
That's a creed.
Yeah.
So it we do have language for it. We just don't use the word creed.
Yeah, we don't call it, yeah,
a creed. Like No Child Left Behind was an educational creed when I was growing up. Like the idea that every student matters and their achievement matters, and we don't just get to leave some students behind because they're difficult or they don't know English.
Yeah.
That's or the Hippocratic Oath is kind of like a creed.
It's a creed, yeah.
It's a
absolutely,
creed.
Yeah.
So that's the Hippocratic Oath, is that doctors will never not do their doctorally duties, no matter how odious the person is or how dire the circumstances.
Yeah.
That there's a creed that doctors live by. Are there other examples of creeds you can think of? And then and why don't we use the word creed, and how are creeds important?
I mean, generally, there are creeds all around us, you know, like in many ways, like long, go to any Silicon Valley startup, there's a decent chance you're going to find some like really eloquent mission statement or something, you know, that's a form of a creed.
Or like even Apple, don't be evil, right?
Yeah.
That was a creed in their, yeah.
Yeah. Or like, you know, I grew up standing up in class at the start of the day, every day, pledging allegiance to the flag. That is, you could call that a creed, you know? So, you know, that might be a good example because I remember doing that growing up. I don't know that schools really do that as much anymore. I'm not sure, but
we did it every day, which seems a little bit much.
We did it every day too.
I'm not, I think it was because of the Cold War. I think people were afraid if they didn't
maybe that
do
was.
It every day.
Yeah. Cause we were elementary kids in the 80s,
yeah,
which is like not that far off from the Cold War.
So I think it was like, hey, listen, we're going to pledge allegiance to this. Otherwise we're going to become communist and then tetherball at lunch.
Dude, I haven't thought about that, but I guess that's what that was.
It was kind of a weird, remember? It was kind of weird.
Yeah. So that's a creed.
Yeah.
And you think about whatever the reasons were, you know, yeah. Like you think about what that did. It's so interesting. I could still recite the Pledge of Allegiance right now. And I haven't in decades, probably. And what that means is during those formative years, reciting the words over and over again, they embedded the words in me. Now,
and the meaning of the words in you too.
Right. Now, when I was reciting them, you know, like rubbing the sleep out of my eyes at 7:30 a.m. in second grade, I wasn't thinking like, oh my gosh, I pledge allegiance to the flag. Wow, what is the flag all about? You know, I wasn't thoughtful about it. I'm just saying the words, right? But because the words are in me, I could now go line by line and be thoughtful about like, what is that? What is that? What does that mean that my allegiance is pledged to a, you know, like it becomes a sort of trampoline or a catapult or a catalyst for really deeply thinking about who I am as an American, as a citizen, on and on.
Right.
And at their best, that's what creeds do. I think they embed themselves in us so that in those moments of need, we're able to go back and remember what is true. And even deeper still, the hope is that as the creeds are embedded in us, they form us into living a particular way.
So how are creeds formational? Like that's because I think what you're trying to say is that the reason for this sermon series is that it's supposed to do something in us.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a sense and I don't know, by the way, I don't remember when I memorized the Apostles' Creed.
Yeah.
I don't know how that got in me. I honestly don't.
Yeah.
It might have been the Rich Mullins song.
Yeah, sure.
Or the third day cover of the Rich Mullins song. Mm. I don't know. How does this Apostles' Creed form us? What is it doing us?
Well, I mean, lots of things, I think. And that's one of the reasons why we'll do the series,
yeah,
is to create sort of a robust, rich understanding of what each of these lines, its implications for our lives. But generally speaking, I think it's what you said, and this is what I talked about on Sunday. One, it sweeps us up into a communal story. So the line, I believe, that refrain, you know, we talked about on Sunday, it's a collective I. Like it reminds you immediately, because the creed is intended to be recited out loud. So across all of our congregations on Sunday, at the end of the teaching, we recited the creed together and you heard the voices of others, you know, I believe. And it's a reminder like, oh, when I say I don't just mean like me. I mean like all of us, the collective I here physically in this place, but globally across the world, you know, and historically followers of Jesus who've gone before us, followers of Jesus who'll come after us. We collectively make up that big grand I. And so that's one thing it should do. The creed is intended to be a communal document that lives not just in me, but in us. And then two, every single line just positions us, it postures us appropriately in the unfolding human story. That, you know, when we say, I believe, it's not just I intellectually believe, it's pistis, faith, it's trust. I trust essentially in the reality of the triune God, you know, God the Father.
Yeah, the
Father,
weird,
Jesus,
the word
the Son,
believe is weird Spirit. Because I was thinking about this on the drive over. Believe, I was thinking believe is most often used in like Christmas, like you just got to believe in Saint Nick. Like believe in Santa, or do you believe in miracles? Like yeah, it's a sport thing. Like that was a Warriors thing, you know, remember?
Yeah. Oh, we believe. Oh,
yeah. We believe Warriors. Yeah. And then Al Michaels, do you believe in miracles in the 1980 hockey team?
Oh yeah.
So there's believe is like, it's almost like a wishy-washy word.
Or a hopeful desire.
But it's
like the We Believe Warriors didn't win the title.
They did not. They got eliminated by the Jazz.
So it was like, we believe in a second round exit or something. Yeah. That's not what we meant, but it was like a hopeful.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is different.
So talk. How is it different? Because you said trust. I love that. So when you think about the word believe, like, what do you think? How would you describe that to somebody when it's not just like wishful thinking? Because a lot of times people think religion is just wishful thinking, you know?
Yeah. We've talked at length here in other teaching series about what we mean by gospel. And what we've said many times is gospel simply means good news. And it's the good news. Something is news only because it's noteworthy. Like, and news is something that has already happened that changes things now and changes the trajectory of what is going to happen. That's news. And the gospel is good news because what has happened is really good for us now, and it's really good for us moving forward. So when we say, I believe, and then it's the whole gospel story, you know, Jesus, God, Jesus, the Spirit, the church, the virgin birth, the death, burial, resurrection, all of that, you know, it means that I put my trust. It's not hopeful, wishful thinking. It's not like, oh, gee, I hope the Warriors can make it to the finals. Like, I don't know if they will, but I hope they do. That's not what it is. It's not wishful thinking, and it's not like hopeful desire. It is sort of anchoring our lives in trust, in faith, that something has happened through Jesus. And that because that thing happened, the resurrection and ascension, then everything about my present and my future changes. And that's what I believe. I trust in that. Yeah. No matter what happens right now, no matter who wins the election, regardless if I get the promotion or not, regardless if my company does well or it tanks, regardless of if my children get into Stanford or Berkeley or UCLA, or they go to junior college, or they just end up getting that job, you know, with whatever, you know, at McDonald's, like whatever it might be, no matter what happens, no matter what cultural pressures I feel, I stake my hope on something that has already happened, not something I hope will happen. And that keeps, you know, that offers stability and peace. And
grounding.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also strikes me that, even as you were talking, one of the words that we don't use a whole lot is the word revelation. And I don't mean the final book of the Bible. The idea that God has revealed himself and wants to be known, and then he revealed himself in history through Jesus. Those are revelatory acts that Christians say, look, we're not making this stuff up.
Yeah.
Like, so there's a sense in which, and this is why it's so grounding for me. It's like, we're not making this up. God revealed this.
Yeah.
And he revealed who his character was, and he revealed it through the story of the Israelites, which we have recorded. But then Jesus is the revelation of God as well, about what God's actually like, and look what he did, and look who he is. Because the creed is super theocentric and Jesus-centric.
Yeah.
It's actually not really human-centric.
At all.
It's just completely about where, and that's another thing we're getting lost in. We're getting lost in who God is and who Jesus is.
Yeah.
The triune God.
That's right.
And that's something that's really big as well. And that's really, for me, that's also really calming and stabilizing.
Yes.
Because I'm flighty.
Yeah.
I'm unpredictable. I'm dumb. I'm pretty good some days, but other days not so much.
Yeah.
This is a God who is like, this is who he is.
Yeah.
He's knowable and known and historically rooted in like human
and
time.
Unchanging.
Yeah. All those things really, really help as well.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's also part of the creed's power.
Yeah, I think so. Again, stability.
Yeah.
There's just real stability in reminding ourselves it's not up to us, you know? And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because I am very finite and limited in my ability, whereas God is not.
Okay, let me ask you one final question, because I was thinking about this. These apostles are taking this message out to different parts of the world. A lot of times, as we know from history, those cultures that they entered into, the people that they encountered, they had no concept of this. So there are edges to this creed. The creed's an invitation, I think, primarily.
Yeah.
But it's also an invitation of, like, of belief, which is to leave one way of thinking and to believe and go and follow another way. Yeah. It's almost like there's a line early on. He's the maker of heaven and earth. That's a radical concept for some of the people these apostles are going to encounter. The idea that there's a maker God, a creator God, that would have confronted a lot of Origen and theological. There's some edges to this creed. How do you see, some people say, oh, it's just tribalism. It's just one more way to divide humans, which, whatever. There are some edges to this creed, though. It pulls out in us the question of what do I believe? I believe this? What are the edges to the creed, and how do you see it doing that kind of formational work?
Yeah, I mean, you know, generally, we kind of started this conversation. It definitely, I don't know if this is the question you're asking exactly, but it definitely disentangles us from the cultural ethic of autonomy, individualism. You know, it pushes us toward the "you are not your own, so honor God with your body" sort of, you know, invitation.
Yeah.
And it's weird. It is like almost everything in the way of Jesus. Initially, it's very hard. And it feels so counterintuitive and countercultural. Like, what are you talking about? I'm not my own, you know? And yet you keep going down that path in faith and in trust, and you realize, oh, actually, surprisingly, shockingly even, that's where freedom is.
Yeah.
It's on the far side of that thing that felt so counterintuitive, you know? Even what you're saying, yes, like for ancient people, for first century people, to say that this one God, this triune God, was the maker of heaven and earth would have been, you know, provocative and insidious in some parts. But you think about it, even culturally today, there's a real gift in that. It's like, oh, you know, this is not really up to me. Like, God made the world and he made it good and we've kind of wrecked it, but he's still going to have his way. It's still going to be a good world, new heavens and new earth. And try as we may, we'll never get there on our own. You know, no matter what Steven Pinker says about human progress, like we just will not get there on our own. You know, this like man-made human utopia is a myth. And I think we're seeing that even secular culture is seeing that more and more every day. But there's a real comfort in that. It's like, you know what? It's not, I don't have to do it. I can't do it, and I don't have to. God is the maker of heaven and earth, and he will remake all of this into a new heaven and a new earth, and it'll be really, really good, you know?
I wonder if there's also, you talked in your message about implicit and explicit knowledge, in essence about kind of truth. That's really what the words are, even if you didn't use the word truth. There's a sense in which our culture, it does seem to be like, you know, they use terms like my truth and your truth.
Yeah.
We use words like that. And part of that, I think people are saying, tell your story.
Yeah, sure.
Which is true. That's fine. But there's also a sense in which my truth, your truth, the idea is that truth is completely relativistic or whatever. This confronts that as well. So there's a sense in which getting lost in a big narrative story that feels arrogant to some. I think it feels arrogant to some, or it seems like that would be, but this is who Christians are.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any way, there's no way around that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, final thought or final question for you as we get out of this, when you look at the creed and you're studying on all this, is there any part of the creed that jumps out at you, as you read it, or that's been particularly comforting to you or inspirational to you when you read like the whole thing as you look at it? And I guess you could say the whole thing, but is there any particular line or any particular aspect of it that's been really comforting?
Oh gosh, man. I mean, yeah, the whole thing. I guess the story, you know, it's so crazy how in two lines that Jesus was crucified, died, and was buried, descended into hell, rose again from the dead on the third day, ascended into heaven, and is seated at the right hand of God the Father. Yeah, I mean, that's probably it for me. I think a lot of Christians, too, that's why we try to be pretty intentional here. We talk about the ascension, I think, more than most, at least in my experience, most sort of evangelical churches. It's because I think the ascension is kind of a lost piece to the whole narrative, but it matters so much. It matters so, so much. Because it means that Jesus rules and reigns as king, you know? He didn't just
resurrect. He's running the universe, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, we don't really we celebrate Easter,
yeah,
and Good Friday,
but even,
and Christmas, but we don't really have an Ascension Day.
Yeah, I mean we do on the church calendar. The evangelical church doesn't tend to. So yeah, that whole line, I love that the Ascension is in there, and it reminds us like that it was critically important to these first followers of Jesus. You know, when you think about the narrative, it's like Jesus comes back to life, and they thought at that point they're like, "This is it." He defeated death. Like they thought that was the end of the story. And Jesus was now his resurrected body who was going to rule and reign and overtake Rome and whatever. But then he doesn't. He's like, see ya. You know? And he ascends. But it you know, the literal meaning of encourage, to give courage, it encourages his followers so much that they go to the ends of the earth and... Here we are today.
Yeah.
You know, so that whole line, you know, the story, his story really moves me.
Well, you know, what got me is, I probably don't have time for this, but I wanted you to have a chance to share if you didn't. The line that got me was, I believe it's near the end, the forgiveness of saints. Mm. I'm sorry, the communion of saints, mm-hmm. the forgiveness of sins, and life everlasting. Mm. I've been reflecting on those, but the life everlasting really hit me. Because you were telling a story about a real life or death situation in our church that just happened.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, you gave a message. And at the end of it, you created some space, which I love. And you've been doing this a little bit more regularly. Creating space for people to respond. Both, here's the pro. And you said, you know, it, like life is a reckoning and Christian life is a reckoning.
Yeah.
All's not well out there in the world, but all's not right with me on the inside. And we can be healed. We can come to God and he can actually, you know, heal us. And you said, if that's not you, if you've never done that,
yeah.
You gave an opportunity for people. And then you gave a chance for people to say, I've forgotten. I need to come back to that. That needs to be more central. That needs to be the central thing. And I've unprioritized it. I've walked away. I've grown cold. I want to come back. You know, the reheating of that. That's kind of we use words like rededicate or, you know, those things. But the first part was if you've never... And you told a story about something that happened kind of in our church. Would you mind kind of sharing that for our folks?
Yeah. I was just with Ben Pierce and I went to go visit this young woman earlier today, and spent some time praying with her. And so, yeah. So the week after that invitation, I'm at church and I wasn't teaching. Lisa was teaching. And I never do this. I literally have never done this. But on this one particular Sunday... during the 4 p.m. service, Lisa's teaching. I'm sort of pastoring the service, but I need to get some emails out. They're time sensitive. So I usually go to my office to finish that up and then head back into the sanctuary. But for some reason, I decided to go sit out in the lobby. And I'm sitting in the lobby and I'm frantically sending some of these emails. And then I can sort of see out of the corner of my eye this woman just lingering. So I close my laptop because I get a sense she wants to talk, and I look up at her and she's just crying, you know, and she sits down and I ask her what's going on. She introduces herself. She says that she and her boyfriend had been going to church for a while, and she's so funny. She's like, we've been living together. We've been living in sin, you know, and it's like this confessional thing. I'm like, it's okay. It's okay. Like, just what's going on? And long story, I mean, it's a beautiful story, but I'll try to keep it succinct. She says the Sunday prior, when I had given the gospel invitation, I usually ask folks to close their eyes just to create some anonymity in the room. And she says she was sitting next to her boyfriend who had grown up going to church but had walked away from faith. But they recently moved from Southern California and Northern California and had decided they wanted to start checking out churches and just re-engage. And so they had been coming to Westgate. They really loved it. And She says, I did what you asked. I closed my eyes, so I wasn't watching. But the room was quiet, and I could hear my boyfriend raise his hand to recommit his life to Christ. I was like, man, that's really beautiful. And then she says, that happened on Sunday, and on Thursday, he passed away. Like, he was a healthy guy, went to the gym all the time, like really healthy, did not abuse his body, took great care of his body, actually, but had a seizure and he died like in their home. And she's just weeping. It was so interesting how God writes stories, you know, like, I mean, in so many ways. What was I doing out there, you know, in that lobby? God knew this woman needed to talk to me at that moment. And what was she doing out there? She said she was just like so overwhelmed with emotion sitting in the room. It was her first Sunday, obviously,
back
without her boyfriend.
Right. Yeah.
And the previous Sunday, he had raised his hand to say yes to Jesus, recommit his life. And she was so emotional. She walked out and then she sees me and she actually sees one of our ushers and he walks over. It's just like really powerful, you know, like, and God knew. Nobody else knew. We didn't know, but God knew, like, you know, all of our days are numbered, and God knew he needed, even for her, like she needed the comfort of hearing, you know, him raising his hand. And she was telling me she could still hear the sound, and that brings her so much comfort, you know, and it's really powerful.
And so, I think that that's why we do this, man, because it's like, these are not just words. These are words of life. This is the way to life. And that's the end of the creed. And life everlasting. Like, that's what this is. That's what all of the words of the creed bring. Jesus is life.
Yeah.
And he's life everlasting. And not just for her boyfriend, you know, and rest in peace, but also for her in this moment and comfort going forward.
Yep.
And also the hope that her boyfriend is not gone.
Right.
He is not lost.
Right.
He is kept by God because of life everlasting. That's what Jesus does.
Yeah.
This is not academic.
Yeah.
This is like real life and death stuff. And the dude was not old, right? He was like
48.
That's like my age. Yeah. That's me. I'm 48. Like, that's way too young to die.
Yeah.
And that's our hope. Yeah. That's our hope, because life, there's no guarantee to me, to you, to anybody tomorrow or the next day or the next day, but these are words of life. And that's, I think, why these creeds matter. Part of the reason why these creeds matter so much. This is life and life everlasting.
That's right.
Thanks for sharing that, man. That's right. You know, prayers for her as she navigates this grief.
Yeah.
And for, pray that our community can be a help to her. Thanks for being here, man.
Yeah. Thank you.
And thanks. And we're going to, you're going on a little vacation.
Yes.
So that's exciting.
Yes.
A little bit of a break. So
when you go on
a break, do you disengage with books or do you read a ton?
I don't read a ton, no, but I'll read.
So it's just long walks on the beach and thinking?
Yeah. Not the beach necessarily, but yeah, walks, sightseeing.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. I like big cities.
Oh yes.
I like national parks too.
Well, when you get back, will you give us a report on your favorite parts?
Yeah, would love to.
I can't wait.
Yep.
We'll have a restful break.
Thank you.
And it's kind of like a mini sabbatical. No, yeah, maybe
it's not that long.
No, it's how about a vacation? An unplugged vacation.
Yeah, that's right.
A long unplugged vacation.
So,
rest and peace to you. And we'll see you when you get back.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Just want to say thanks to Jay Kim for stopping by. Join me next week when we continue on in the Apostles' Creed and we talk about God the Father, Almighty, Maker of heaven and earth. There's a lot in that simple phrase. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.